Welcome to Ida History, the show that digs up the most thought-provoking stories from Idaho's history. Here are your hosts, Jeff Wade and Mark Iverson.
That's right. This is Ida History. I'm your host, Jeff Wade, sitting many miles away from my co-host, Mark. What's up, Mark?
I'm speaking into some large ball called a snowball, some strange device from a future age.
Yeah, so you're taking a little trip, so we decided to try this on the interwebs this time.
Oh, yeah, the interweb.
Hopefully it works out for us. Right. The interweb. But Mark, why don't we get into this really quick? Tell us what we're talking about today.
Well, so on this episode, it'll serve as an introduction to a huge topic, and that's the topic of Japanese incarceration in Idaho during the Second World War. And so we're talking about Japanese Americans and Japanese nationals that have lived here for a long time or had. And we're going to talk about, for a few minutes about how that came to be. And then we'll play an interview that Jeff did with a descendant of a couple who met and were married at the Minidoka camp in Idaho.
Yeah, so Maggie Takuda Hall, she's a children's book author who wrote a book called Love in the Library. It's about her grandparents' love story. It's a great way to teach kids about the camps. And I chose to do this episode with her interview as kind of a, like you said, as an introduction to the whole topic of Japanese incarceration in the United States and in Idaho. And I kind of hope that the interview with her kind of puts more of a personal face on the issue. Definitely need to remember that these were actual people, not this, a lot of times we kind of push that away from our minds when we talk about stuff like this, right?
Right, you are, yeah.
So Mark, why don't we start today with December 7th, 1941?
Yep, that's right. A day that will, lives and will live in infamy, according to FDR. It was the day the Japanese conducted a surprise attack on the U.S. military base at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, on the Big Island, on Oahu, excuse me. The next day, Congress declared war on Japan, pulling the United States into the Second World War.
In the months after the attack, the West Coast was in a state of panic, thinking that an invasion by Japanese forces was to come. Soon, rumors started to spread that saboteurs were hiding among the nation's population of Japanese Americans.
The fear that Japan would use these secret agents to lay the groundwork, coupled with some good old racial prejudice, whipped many white Americans into a fury. Much of the time, this racism and discrimination was written into the laws of the land.
So going back to 1790, Congress passed the Naturalization Act, which allowed any free white person to become a naturalized citizen. After the Civil War, the act was amended to prohibit Chinese people from becoming citizens, and that was in 1870. It was assumed that this prohibition would extend to Japanese people or any, quote, Oriental, an assumption which was then confirmed by the Supreme Court in 1922. That case was called Ozawa versus the United States. But the 14th Amendment guarantees the right of birthright citizenship to anyone born in the country. So you have this situation where the Japanese people coming over are, their children are U.S. citizens, even if they're not allowed to be.
Right. Yeah. In the 1860s, the United States, had a need for cheap labor. In the West, small-scale placer mining, or placer mining. Which one is it, Jeff? Placer?
Placer. Yeah. I say placer, but I think it's placer usually. Placer.
Yeah. Calvary. Just kidding. Hey, it's all the same juju to me. No, actually, it's totally different. But anyway, yeah. Placer mining gave way to large hard rock mining operations, as well as the building of the railroad. Chinese people, ravaged by the Taiping rebellion and economic depression, saw the U.S. as an opportunity to feed their families. By 1870, California's population was 10% Chinese.
An economic depression in the 1870s was blamed on the cheap labor provided by these Chinese immigrants. After immense pressure by business interests, labor unions, as well as both Republican and Democratic parties in California, Congress passed a Chinese exclusion bill in 1880. But that was vetoed by President Hayes. President Chester A. Arthur vetoed a similar bill in 1882, but agreed to sign a bill stopping Chinese immigration for 10 years, which ended up being extended all the way up to 1943. And that was called the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882.
During this time, Japan was under a period of rapid industrialization, which displaced workers. Reports of open jobs in the U.S. reached these workers who began immigrating. The Alaskan Gold Rush drained the Pacific Northwest of much of its existing labor pool, especially those who, you know, had been working on the railroads. The Japanese came to fill in these labor gaps.
Unfortunately, they were subjected to the same xenophobia that the Chinese were. Japanese people settled in insular and isolated communities. Because they could not become citizens, they were often barred from participating in politics, meaning these communities did not have representation in the lawmaking process. Pretty sure we, you know, we fought a whole war of independence because of that kind of thing, right?
Right you are. Right you are. In 1913, California passed a law which barred Japanese immigrants from owning land. A devastating move, to be sure, since many were farmers. Japanese were known as good farmers, who could take less favorable lands and transform them into productive farms, which, you know, fast forward to 1941, had a lot to do with the Japanese internment.
So during the raid on Pearl Harbor, a Japanese plane crash-landed on one of the smaller Hawaiian islands. The island's residents, unaware of what happened on Oahu, helped the pilot. One of the Japanese residents was especially helpful, but when the news of the attack reached the island, tribal leaders tried to arrest the pilot to turn him in. There was a scuffle over a gun, and the pilot was killed. The Japanese man who helped the pilot, knowing he would be blamed, also shot himself right there on the spot.
Wow. Back on the mainland, this incident was used as a proof that Japanese Americans were ready to help an invading Japanese army. Citizens called on the government to prevent that from happening, and the idea to remove all people of Japanese descent from the West Coast started to work its way up the government channels. Voices for and against Japanese removal started to be heard. Earl Warren, who would go on to become the Chief Justice of one of the most civil rights-minded Supreme Courts in U.S. history, was very vocally in favor of the removal. At the time, he was the Attorney General of California.
So speaking of attorney generals, Idaho's attorney general is a guy named Burt Miller. And at the time he said, quote, "We want to keep this a white man's country and all Japanese should be put in concentration camps for the remainder of the war and no attempt should be made to provide work for them."
By December 10th, 1941, the U.S. Department had already rounded up, U.S. Justice Department, excuse me, had already rounded up 2,300 enemy aliens, of which 1,300 were Japanese. But when the idea of removing all Japanese from the West Coast came forward, Attorney General Francis Biddle opposed it. He issued a memo on the same day calling for a peaceful roundup of Japanese nationals, asking people not to mistreat them. In the coming weeks, Biddle would butt heads with the War Department and its head general, John DeWitt, who would become the driving force behind incarceration.
Biddle continued to fight against the idea of mass incarceration of the Japanese Americans until February 17th, when he issued a final memo to President Roosevelt stating his opposition to the removal. FDR then informed Biddle that he had granted approval to the War Department to begin laying the groundwork for Japanese incarceration, completely bypassing the Attorney General and the DOJ.
On February 19th, 1942, President Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066. It authorized the forced removal of all persons deemed a threat to national security from the West Coast to relocation centers, quote, end quote. In many cases, Japanese American citizens were only given 48 hours notice to pack their belongings and sell off their homes, businesses, and farmlands, almost always at a loss. Some left their businesses in the hands of people they thought they could trust, but this often did not work out well.
Japanese Americans were moved to temporary holding areas called assembly centers. Often these were places like fairgrounds, and so horse stalls and pig pens were temporary quarters for many of these people, I mean, these families, men, women, children. From there, they were put on train cars in order to keep the shades drawn.
Yeah, so, to me, that sounds eerily similar as far as a system than some of our enemies, in Europe were doing, right? It's kind of scary. But 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry were shipped to 10 different incarceration camps across the U.S., with 13,000 winding up in Idaho at the Minidoka camp. Most of them were there, you know, throughout the war, but some would later have the opportunity to work as farm laborers, you know, or join the army to fight in Europe.
So I forgot to put in why they chose Minidoka as a site for this, but basically it was federal land that wasn't being used, and it was away from any infrastructure or, you know, anything that a potential Japanese agent could, you know, blow up or harm, you know, that kind of thing, right?
Right. You know, and we've said this before, but the thing is the Japanese weren't dumb enough to use Japanese people as spies. You know, that was too obvious. So we're going in the wrong direction, you know, back then. But, you know, also I wanted to say that, you know, those men that chose to fight, Japanese American men who chose to fight from the camps around the U.S., became some of the most, if not the most decorated units of World War II. You know, yes. They wanted to prove that they were not.
Right. Of course. Yeah. Later on, they had to fill out like a form saying that they're not loyal to the Japanese government and that they're loyal to the United States. And then one of the questions on there was, were they willing to fight? And the ones, you know, a lot of them did sign up and they were given, I don't know if you call it going into the army, their freedom, but yeah, they were able to join the military and go fight in Europe. They didn't fight in the Pacific, right?
I don't believe so, but I'm no expert on that. I do know the majority, from what I understand or have ever read about, fought against, you know, the Germans and I think Italians for a brief moment. But
back to Minidoka, it was a literal concentration camp. Barbed wire fences, guard towers with guns pointing into the camp, and large dormitory-style barracks, which held several families each. It was hot in the summer with frequent dust storms, freezing cold in the winter. In the spring, it was muddy, and the shared latrines were difficult to get to. I mean, if you've ever spent any time in southern Idaho, you know how harsh the desert can be.
Right, and you know, nasty those latrines at like national parks or state parks can be too, man. But we differentiate, you know, as far as a concentration camp in this American context from those created by, you know, Nazi Germany, in the sense that there are different types of concentration camps, you know, and those in Europe were really labor death camps and extermination centers. In the United States, Order 9066 called for prisoners to be fed, housed, and not much else, you know, concentration camps, concentrating one population in one area behind, you know, bars or fences that they can't get out of. But they did have some amenities, and one of them was a library.
And I think that sets the stage for my interview with Maggie. And why don't we go ahead and give that a listen, Mark?
Yeah, it's a good one.
Hello, everyone. This is Jeff from Idaho History, and I'm sitting here with Maggie Tokuda Hall. Did I pronounce your family name correctly? Okay. Can you pronounce it for me?
Tokuda Hall.
Tokuda.
Yeah.
Okay. Maggie Tokuda Hall. Welcome to Idaho History. Thank you for sitting down with me today.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you so much for having me.
Today, we're going to talk about a book that you wrote called Love in the Library. But first, let's talk about you and some of the stuff you do. You're a writer, and then I saw that you're a baker as well on your website. So tell us about you and what you do.
Yeah, I'm a children's and young adult book author. My fifth book comes out this fall, and I've got a few more books lined up down the pipeline. And like my website says, I'm in a pretty okay amateur baker.
That's awesome. So you wrote a book called Love in the Library, which I have a copy right here. Great book. So
thank you.
Why did you write this book, I guess, is the big question.
Yeah. So Love in the Library is the true story of how my maternal grandparents met in a Japanese incarceration camp during World War II. And it's a story that I've just like always known. It defined how I understand my place in this country and how American history functions. But I didn't think about writing it as a children's book until early 2017, when President Trump took office, and his first executive order was the travel or Muslim ban. And I remember being really afraid and really sad and really scared that was how he was planning to use this time in office, and I tried to think what I had to offer children in that period of time. And I realized I had this beautiful story in my family, not just about the cruelty of those kinds of policies, but also about the incredible resilience of the people who they target.
So let's talk about your grandparents. Can you introduce them and maybe give us some background of their early lives and how they came to Minidoka?
Yeah. So my grandfather was George Takuda. He grew up in a logging camp outside of Seattle. He became a pharmacist. When he was incarcerated, he had two pharmacies open at that period of time, and he lost both of them while he was incarcerated. He was about 30 years old. And then my grandmother, Tama, grew up in Seattle proper in the International District. And she was a senior in college at University of Washington. And she did not get her degree until I think it was like 2012 when they awarded all the people who were incarcerated during that period of time their degrees. But most of them had already died by that period of time. And so that ceremony was pretty sad. And she became the camp librarian because she was an English student and a writer. And so she loved books, and that was the job she took in the camp. And George would go in every single day and check out a bajillion books. He had zero intention of reading, so he could go flirt with her. And they fell in love and they got married.
It's really a kind of a cute love story set on the backdrop of one of the most tragic incidents in American history. Right. You mentioned that your grandmother was supposed to graduate college, and you actually talk about that in the book. You mentioned that it was about a year in, and she should have already graduated by that point. So this is 1943, 44, somewhere in there.
Earlier, I think 19. Oh my God. For how often I talk about this? Right. Hold on.
So Executive Order 9066 was signed February 19th, 1942. So,
right. So the book takes place in 1943.
Okay.
But they got there in 1942.
Right. You mentioned your grandfather's pharmacies. I did a little research on him online, and I believe, didn't he leave them for a friend to manage and then kind of lost them that way?
Friend is a loose term. He entrusted them to someone, and she kind of ran them both into the ground.
Okay.
And so when he came out, they just weren't there anymore.
And that kind of thing happened.
Had to start over from scratch.
Yeah, and that kind of thing happened quite a bit with Japanese American citizens, mm-hmm. where they would, you know, leave their businesses to someone that they thought they could trust, or they had to sell them outright in their homes. Yeah, and they had to sell them outright for a big loss, basically what they could sell them for to get whatever money they could.
Yeah.
So the Minidoka camp, they're, according to what I've seen, there's about 13,000 people incarcerated there at one time, and mm-hmm. they had everything, you know, well, not what they needed, but they had the basics. They had, you know, I guess food, they had shelter. But it's interesting that you set this story, and the story set in the library, which is a place that sounds like your grandmother could go to kind of find some peace or some, you know, to get away from everything else that was going on around her in the camp and in the country.
I mean, for readers, I think books are always a refuge, but they're never as encompassing as we wish they were in that regard.
Your book is illustrated by Yaz Imamura. Beautifully illustrated, by the way. Thank you. Beautifully illustrated, especially the there's a page in there where kind of shows the imagination of the reader, and there's mm-hmm. knights. It's just an incredibly beautiful image to look at. So I really love
Yaz that. Yaz is a deeply talented illustrator, and this book was so meaningful to work on with her. And she handled it with so much respect and so much reverence, and I really feel like she brought the full scope of her talent to this, and I'm very grateful for her.
Yeah, it really is beautiful.
That spread you were talking about with all the things that she's imagining in the book kind of manifesting around her is an image that she just like blew us so far out of the water with, that in my original text, it had described all those images. It was like knights in shining armors, windmills, whatever. And when we saw Yaz's illustrations, we're like, oh, just cut all of that. Like, she's doing all this work. It's so beautiful and so elegant on its own. You don't need me there. And that's such a indication of her talent.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty incredible, honestly. And then even kind of the backdrop of the camp on the cover, you know, you're looking mm-hmm. at your grandparents in the library, and then through the window, you see that guard tower in the background. It's such a mm-hmm. kind of a, how she drew that, just like a stark difference between, you know, what's going on within your grandparents' relationship and their, you know, their budding relationship and what's going on, like I said, on the outside. So it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, she did a really good job. And we talked about it explicitly about like what needs to be said in the text, what needs to be shown to give kids the like honesty of what was going on there, that there were men with guns and those guns were pointed in.
Right.
You know, like there has to be that sense of peril and fear kind of all the time. But if it was constantly in the text, you would never be able to kind of engage with the rest of the story. And so I think she handled it so beautifully and we gave her a lot to handle with it.
Yeah, you both did a great job just telling the story and you seeing it at the same time, I guess, how the story moves along and how those images really backdrop your text. It's just beautiful. So let's talk more about your grandparents. So you said mm-hmm. at the beginning, this is kind of the story that you had already always kind of known, right? I'm assuming the family mm-hmm. kind of passed it down as an oral kind of tradition, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So when you went to write the book, did you have to do a lot of research into the camp or your grandparents' lives? What did that look like?
No, the research that I did was more about the school presentations that I give in conjunction with this book, because I have to give kids the full context. And I'm really careful to always use my notes when I present this book, because I want my history to be 100% correct. But for the actual story, I know that story like I know that the sky is blue. Right. It was not a question of its historical accuracy. The checking that I did the most was for tone. And so my mother is a journalist. And so she's like the perfect person to have been able to kind of like look over my shoulder while I do this, because she's so dedicated to telling the truth. And I had written Tama originally as like much more angry, because that's how I would have been. And so I kind of projected that onto her. And my mom was like, you know, that's not really accurate. Like George was angry. George kept records of everything he had lost. And like, you know, he was ready to like tell anyone who would listen, like how bad what had happened to them, what it was. And, but Tama was just really sad. Like it was like really crushing for her and it was frightening, but she wasn't angry. It was a different feeling. And so that was like the biggest check and change that I had to make.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Definitely good to have that support behind you, your mother being able to write this book. And really, this is like your family legacy, I guess, right? For mm-hmm. better or for worse.
Yeah.
So war comes to an end. Some of the Japanese people or Japanese Americans were able to leave the camp before the war ended. What did that look like for your grandparents?
Yeah. So coming and going after, I think like 1944, was pretty porous. Both my grandparents relocated to Chicago, to try to get work, but Tama was pregnant and the racism against Japanese Americans was so thick then that doctors wouldn't treat her. And when she went there, she would get called racial slurs. And like, it was just really frightening. So she opted to go back to Minidoka, so that she could receive prenatal care.
Oh, wow.
And, try to deliver the baby safely.
Right.
And so, George came back a little bit after that. But he had been working in Chicago and then he left for Seattle before she did. And actually, this is one of my favorite stories that isn't in the book. So George left and went back to Seattle before Tama, and he actually stayed with a Chinese-American friend named Bill Ang, which was like kind of unusual because the Japanese-American community in Seattle was like pretty insular, and so having friends outside of the community was not necessary, like wasn't common. So he was staying with Bill, and he was kind of just venting and telling him, you know, I'd lost everything. I don't have any money. I have this wife. I have this kid. Everything's gone. I don't know what I'm going to do, like how I'm going to support them. And Bill went down into the basement where he was literally storing money under a mattress and pulled a bunch out for George and told him to pay him back when he could. And he even put up actually George and then Tama and their son Floyd when she came out of the campus as well, because they didn't have a home yet. But our family has never forgotten what he did for us. I don't know where we would be without his kindness.
Oh, that is an incredible act of kindness on his behalf. It's very touching. So their oldest, Tama and George's oldest child, was born in the camp, correct?
That's right. He was born in Minidoka.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
With a lot of developmental and birth defects.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I just can't imagine being a family and trying to raise, you know, a newborn baby in that kind of environment. It must have been very, very tough for Tama and George.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember my mom told me a story about her trying to hobble to where the delivery area was, because, you know, Minidoka is not like a tightly packed little like space. And so she had to walk like, I think it was like a couple miles while she was in labor.
Yeah, the camp was actually fairly spread out over a big area, and there were so many barracks buildings and different buildings like that. So I can imagine, yeah. And the conditions of the camp were pretty terrifying as well. In the summer, in the summer you have crazy storms, dust storms, wind storms. In the winter you have very, very cold and very wet conditions, and it's out there on the plain. Yeah. So are there any other stories of your grandparents that you like to tell, or what do you want our listeners to know here in Idaho? What do you want them to know about Minidoka and your grandparents?
Oh gosh, that's so much.
Sorry.
I mean, there's so much I want everyone to know.
Right.
But I guess for people who are close to Minidoka and maybe don't know about it, I think for so much of American history, we don't realize often the buried histories of marginalized people that we're literally stepping on top of. And it can be unsettling to find a painful history literally underneath your feet. But the greatest thing you can do for the people who suffered those histories is to learn them and to tell the truth about them. Because when we talk about them as if they are each aberrations, we fail to understand patterns within our own history. What happened to my grandparents wasn't unique. They're not the first group of people in the United States to be incarcerated because of an imaginary threat that they posed to national security. This isn't something that we left behind in the past. And a thing that is important to remember is that in Korematsu versus the United States, it was revealed that the United States government knew at the time of incarceration that Japanese Americans posed zero military threat. But they didn't care. They needed a scapegoat to look like they were doing something to keep people safe, to kind of mollify angry Americans. And they were perfectly willing to use Japanese Americans for that. And we still do that now.
Right. So Mark and I did a couple episodes about the Aryan Nations here in Idaho a while back. And when we were posting on social media about it, we had a lot of comments like, why are you talking about this? This is something that should be put in the past and forgotten. And our big thing is, no, we need to talk about the stuff so it can be remembered so it doesn't happen again.
I mean, I think it's much more comfortable to forget it.
Yeah.
Right?
Definitely.
Like, I think that's something that people want to do because it's easier. But it just creates, like you said, it creates the opportunity for it to keep on happening and for us to fail to recognize patterns of it.
Exactly. So can we talk a little bit about your experience with publishing your book? And then, so you published it through Candlelick Press. And then after that, was it Scholastic that wanted to pick it up later, or was the...
Yes. Okay. So Candlewick is my publisher. I work with the editor, Karen Lotz. And I love working with them. I think I have 4 books with them and a 5th one coming.
Very good.
And then Scholastic wanted to license the book about a year after it came out. And they wanted to include it in like an AANHPI stories initiative that they would push out to like schools all over the country. And Scholastic is kind of unique because they have relationships, like direct relationships with like 90% of public schools in the country, which is wild.
So this would have been
no other publisher does that.
This would have been a very big deal for you.
It's a big deal. Like, it doesn't guarantee sales, but it does guarantee exposure. And Candlewick is a small house. Like, they do such beautiful work. Every single book that they make is a work of art. But they don't have that same infrastructure that Scholastic has. And so Scholastic wanting to license it was a really exciting opportunity.
So at the end of your book, you have an author's note. And in it, you talk a little bit about your grandparents and how about this is a true story. But then you use a word in there that Scholastic wasn't fond of. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. I call what happened to them virulent racism. Racism, because that's what it was.
Yeah.
I use the word twice. And then I go on to kind of explain how it relates to other moments in American history and things that are happening right now. It's an extremely incomplete list because there's not enough room in that author's note or on this podcast to like get into every single one of them. But like, you know, I just sort of make it clear that this is not an isolated incident and it was racist. It was a racist policy. And Scholastic wanted me to cut the whole paragraph that situated it within history. And they also wanted me to cut the word racism altogether in order to license with them. And I did ask follow up and asked, like, is my offer contingent on this edit? And the answer was yes. So I said no.
Which is very...
And I said no publicly.
Yeah, it's very admirable for you to do so, because, like I said, you lost what might have been a pretty big publishing deal for you. You didn't just stop there with saying no, correct? You actually pressed the issue with Scholastic, correct?
I said no publicly, and I made the letter I sent back to them public. And so because that then kind of picked up a lot of traction and there was a lot of outrage about what had happened, Scholastic reached out to me and had asked me to have a meeting with them. And so I didn't like demand a meeting with them.
Okay.
It was a thing that happened as a result of going public.
Okay.
And in the meeting, it kind of became clear to me that I didn't get the sense that this wasn't going to happen again. I wasn't able to be given an honest recounting of what had happened. They didn't have a plan to make sure that this didn't happen again. And this happened because of this rising culture of book bans, right? And so yes. They were like worried that they were limiting their audience with my book because my book is exactly the kind of book that tends to be banned.
Right.
And so I asked them like, well, how do you intend to fight this rising culture of book bans? And that was the most disappointing answer because the answer was basically nothing.
Right.
And they're a $1 billion company. They have the resources to fight this fight and they should because it's an existential threat for them.
So in your blog post, I think it was on May 8th, you basically talked about the only thing you wanted out of this was for them to make some positive changes to their acquisitions process.
Yes.
So that's looking about 2 months ago. Have you heard anything back from Scholastic after that?
I have. I talked to two of the people that they hired that do not work for the company to kind of audit their process. And I gave them my honest assessment of what I thought was going on and, you know, why it was so offensive. And I hope that Scholastic listens to the report that they assemble, but they're still assembling it. And I do know that like actual institutional change takes a really long time. And I'm absolutely willing to be patient for that. But in the meantime, they can't license my book.
Honestly, I think
they
that's
all. That they're not up to the responsibility of it.
Yeah, honestly, I think that's all quite reasonable of, you know, to ask.
I mean, I think so.
Yeah. I mean, you're not asking for much. I don't think you're asking for much, honestly. But
no, I didn't. Like, I'm not asking for anything other than like, just don't do this to other people.
Yeah, because it's more of a cultural change that I think the whole United States needs to go through. Yes. In order for that to actually happen, right?
I mean, on the one hand, yes. But on the other hand, Scholastic has a unique place in the market where they have poised themselves as being the resource for literature for schools. And so they have a higher responsibility to publish honest history. and to not pander to the people who want to kind of return to the comfortable pablum of jingoism.
Right.
That's not educational. That doesn't serve our children. It doesn't serve us. And so I hope that they take this moment to be better and to just publish better history.
Definitely. Honest history. Yeah. No, I really like that kind of concept. We're involved with the Boise Band Book Club, and you know, we talk.
Hey, yeah, I love to hear it.
Yeah. So we talk a lot about, you know, they do meetings once in a while and they read, you know, banned books, and they actually stood up against a very right-wing Christian conservative group that was actually trying to dismantle a whole library district in our area. And this,
oh my God.
Yeah, it was terrible just because there were a couple books on the shelves that this group didn't like. And yeah, so the Boise Band Book Club, along with some other organizations in the Valley, they got together and they really fought against this group. And it turned out well. The commissioners ruled against that group, and you know, the library still there. Fortunately, there's this history that we've talked about with the Aryan Nations and with some of the Christian identity movements in Idaho, where it's these people who are very vocal yet are in a very small minority who come into areas like this mm-hmm. and try to make what they feel is right, make that the way. And you know, I'm very proud of Idahoans for actually standing up against that stuff, and it's not very well known, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So we like to talk about that kind of thing whenever possible.
Yeah, it's really frightening, and it's so un-American at its heart.
It really is.
And I wish more people made that argument about it, or it's like, I'm sorry, what you're asking for is very un-American.
And it's the people who say that they are the true Americans that are pushing this stuff, right?
Yeah. And I was like, I'm sorry, do you not understand what freedom of speech means?
Yep.
Yeah. Like, it was the first thing we said was super important about us as a country.
Yep. Number one there. Yeah, that's, I'm
like, yeah, no one is ever obligated to buy a book.
True.
If you don't like it, don't buy it.
Yeah.
Let the market speak.
Or no one's forced to go check out books from libraries.
Yeah.
One other question that I want, I know it's a very frustrating subject, isn't it?
Yeah.
So one of the other big questions I have for you is, how did Order 9066 affect Japanese Americans down through history to this day? How do you think that changed the course of history for Japanese Americans?
Yeah, I mean, that's such a big question, and I am not an expert.
That's fine. But you what personally
I
live
can
it.
Speak
so,
to is, yeah, like my own experience.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's this inheritance of anxiety and trauma. Like, there have been studies done about on Japanese Americans and sort of like how anxious we are as a population. And it's because the people who raised us are genuinely afraid that the government could come at any moment and lock us up. You know, and so there was a real resistance to talking about it. And I am really lucky that I come from a family that was really frank about it. But a lot of people don't know where this pain comes from. They just experience this fear and this anxiety without understanding why it is this way. And so a lot of Yonsei, which is like my generation, are starting to talk about this in terms of our mental health. And like, and I think that that is the best way to talk about it for ourselves. And also the best way to try to empathize with other marginalized groups who have experienced other kinds of state-sanctioned racism. What does it mean to be afraid of the government? What does that do to your mental health? It's not good.
Yeah, that's an incredible perspective. A lot of people don't think about that and, you know, really take the time to try to understand that, which I think is very sad. Well, I think we'll wrap this up. Do you have anything else you want to tell my listeners about, you know, the, you know, your book or, you know, anything that we've talked about today?
You know, there's just so many beautiful books about Japanese incarceration. And I hope, I hope you read mine, but I also hope you read books like We Are Not Free by Tracy Chi, or We Refuse, which is a graphic novel that collects the stories of people who tried to resist incarceration. And Seen and Unseen by Betsy Bird and, Tamaki is the illustrator's last name, is a really beautiful nonfiction book about understanding how we talk about incarceration by looking at three different photographers' treatments of it.
Oh, wow.
And there's just so many resources to understanding this. And I hope they look at some of them.
Yeah. Thank you for those recommendations. I'll definitely be checking those out myself. Oh, one more thing. You had a trip planned to go see Minidoka for yourself. That didn't quite work out, but you're planning on doing that someday, correct?
Absolutely. There's a yearly pilgrimage, and I'll attend as soon as I can.
Oh, very cool. Well, let us know. Maybe we can meet you down there or something and check it out for ourselves. That'd be a great trip.
Great. Thank you so much for having me today. No,
thank you for coming on. Thank you for your time. I really appreciate you and your perspective on this incredible situation that happened in our country at one point. Where can our listeners find your books and your website and social media, all that? You know how to do this part, right?
Yeah. My website is prettyokmaggie.com. And you can find information about all my books and things like that there. You can follow me on Twitter at EMTEHALL or on Blue Sky TikTok. Yeah, Blue Sky or TikTok at Maggie Tacunda Hall.
All right. Very good. Well, once again, thank you for coming on Ida History and telling us your story.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
All right. So again, I'd like to thank Maggie for coming on to Ida History and sharing the story of her grandparents and, talking about how that's affected Japanese Americans since. And we had a good discussion about book bans there at the end. So Mark, what do you think?
You know, I think it's kind of shameful what Scholastic asked her to do and take racism out of the text. If you take racism out of the text and don't keep that as part of the story, then you're erasing the whole history of it. That's the whole point, is that the United States gave in to fear and xenophobia and racism and how that, why that happened. It was fear. And that needs to be taught so that we can improve upon that. So if you take that out, you know, the whole point is of the book is gone, you know, in my opinion.
You know, one of the comments she makes in there, and I didn't really catch it while we were talking, still working on those interview skills, but she mentions that these are the types of books that are often targeted by these book bans. And even if, you know, she didn't use that word racism in her author's note, like, it's still the kind of book that would be targeted by a book ban. One of my favorite books is by Sherman Alexie, what is that one called? Do you remember that one, Mark?
I don't know. It's your favorite book, homie.
I know. I'm blanking on it, though. Anyway, Sherman Alexie is a from the Spokane tribe. And so my point is that I'm trying to make here is that the books that these people are trying to ban are often by marginalized voices. And they're a way just, you know, the book bans are, you know, on the face, they're like, yeah, we're protecting kids. But it's like, okay, you're protecting them from hearing the perspectives on other people that don't look like you. So,
well, you know, another book I was reading into, I was in Oregon. I was at Bend, Oregon, and we were at a bookshop and I saw this history of banned books, you know? And so it just went through all the books, you know, that had been banned, since ever. And a huge book, but they were talking about Grapes of Wrath by Steinbeck. Mm-hmm. You know, because it goes against that idea of what America is, the perfection that is American exceptionalism, because these people were ravaged by poverty, starving within America, you know, and they did not like capitalism at all at that moment. Many of them, they're just trying to survive, right? But, you know, it was a lot of the crony capitalism that got them in that situation. And so this was a very negative look into capitalism at that time. And so it was banned. They wanted to ban that. But here's the funny thing. All those books that were banned are some of the most classic widely read books of all time. It doesn't work. It makes more interest in it.
It does. It really does. The book I was referring to is The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian by Sherman Alexie. That's a great book.
And why was that banned? Yeah, I want to show you
that, because he talks about masturbation.
Oh, God forbid.
Right. Everybody poops.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Anyway.
I want to shout out Boise Band Book Club again. You can check them out on Instagram at Boise Band Book Club. I think they do like a book a month is what they looks like they're reading on their schedule right now.
It's basically all women. I had a drink with Chelsea, the arranger organizer of that, and she owns Pearl House Collective online bookshop, trying to get brick and mortar, but it's always women. I was one of the only males to be involved, and we read Toni Morrison's
Pale Rider.
Yeah, Pale Rider by Toni Morrison. No, Blue-Eyed something. Oh, what's the title? Anyway, it was a banned book. Very good book. I still have like 10 pages to go, but it's an amazing book.
The
Bluest Eye. Thank you. And it's a remarkable book that should be lauded and put in schools, you know, not this, but it talks about real drives of sexuality and young adults, you know, and so this is bad, but they're very real things that people feel. And, you know, there are other reasons it was banned, but yeah, these great works of art. But yeah, my applause to the Banned Book Club. Come on, guys, get out there and read some banned books.
Yes, please. The other thing, Mark, I wanted to hit on really quick is talk about the Anne Frank Memorial in Boise and their statue of the other that they have there. Our friends, Natalie and Shane, just talked about this on the Boise Bubble podcast a couple weeks ago. And that statue of the other is interesting because it shows the spiral. So, like, starts off big at the top and then it spirals down almost like it looks like a tornado to me, basically.
Right.
But it kind of shows like how at the top you have language and how you refer to people. And then by the time you get to the bottom of the spiral, you're carting people off into concentration camps and stuff like that. So Mark, do you have anything on that?
Yeah, I actually, I was involved in that project because Dan Prinsing, the ex-director, asked me to write about some of my experiences in Bulgaria and the Peace Corps. And then also, you know, my time in Bosnia when I was doing my basically research into the genocide that happened there in the 90s. And I wrote about elimination, you know, the bottom part of the spiral. But, you know, it was clear in this collection of essays that people wrote for, you know, you can find it online on their website. You can download it for free. This collection of essays in this ebook, they're each writing a chapter for each level of the spiral of descent or spiral of injustice. And, you know, you realize that it really is in most every case that I've ever read about where, you know, mass murder, genocide is the result. It always begins with going after the books, stifling the language, deeming that group as dangerous or inferior. And then that justifies in the minds of perpetrators the right to commit discrimination and then later violent acts. So you discriminate, and then perhaps this increases the poverty of that group. And then they look impoverished and poor and perhaps dirty. And then you can say, see, they're subhuman. They're not the same as us. And then you have this descent into violence. And then organized and many cases, exterminatory violence, you know, and that's what this descent is all about. And, you know, we didn't get to the extermination bit here in the United States, but, you know, Maggie's grandparents definitely experienced the discrimination and the, you know, mass incarceration on no constitutional grounds of 120,000 American citizens, you know, and You know, so we were way down in that spiral, you know, and we need to know that, and we need to learn about it.
We need to learn from that.
Right, exactly. And this is her book is a great way to do that. Like Anne Frank was a way to introduce, even though that's not like the Anne Frank we had know popularly was an edited version. Her father couldn't bear to have his daughter not have her image pristine. So it's not the official version, but you know, it is a good segue for students to learn about the Holocaust through one person, which makes the, you know, inhuman, at least have a human face so you can feel it. And well, I think that's what Maggie's doing.
A lot of the stuff that was cut out from the Anne Frank diary was about her talking about her sexuality as well, I believe, right?
Yeah, because what, she was 13, 14, something like that, right? Yeah. So she's starting to find boys attractive.
Yeah, so it's so weird to me that we will ignore or we'll try to get rid of something based on talks of sexuality and just take out all the other good stuff that we actually need to be hearing about. I don't know, it's weird to me.
Well, she also talked about her anger, right? She's almost saintly because she doesn't talk about how angry she was, but she was angry, you know. Right. But I think that what Maggie's doing is similar in the sense that this is a sweet story in an awful situation. So it's bittersweet, right? But something good did come out of this for them, which is nice to hear. But like she said in the interview, it wasn't like they just left it with no like bitter feelings or, you know, I mean, this messes people up. This lasts for generations. And this is what, I mean, this is what you talk about the various Native American tribes, and you get this generational trauma thing. It creates poverty in many cases, not in the case, I don't believe, of Japanese Americans, but you know, you get these generational traumas that last, well, hundreds of years, you know, in many cases. So, yeah.
All right.
All things you miss if you don't, all things you miss if you don't, you know, read these books, and if Scholastic cuts part of it that's really important or doesn't want something to be said, you know, it diminishes the message and the educational ability of this book to be successful.
Exactly. Can't say it better myself. So Mark, we're going to be exploring more of the Japanese experience in Idaho and more of Japanese incarceration in Idaho later on. So for our listeners, look forward to that. Definitely an important topic that we need to talk about. It's really interesting too. Like once you get into the details of what, you know, they went through and, you know, how they lived in Idaho and stuff like that. So yeah, I'm excited to keep researching this.
Yeah. Right. I think you're going to talk about Minidoka more. I'm going to look into a smaller camp that was for Japanese nationals, longtime residents, but not necessarily not American citizens. And it was run, like you mentioned it, to the Justice Department, managed by the INS, Immigration Naturalization Services, something like that. And, you know, I'm going to talk about this camp, Kushka, which was much smaller, but it was a labor camp and voluntary. But you're going to talk about Minidoka and the differences we'll definitely outline.
Definitely. All right. Well, Mark, you have anything else really quick?
No, great interview. I learned a lot. And I want to get this book for my kids, so I think I will.
Yeah, my oldest just turned 12, so he's going to be reading it here next time. Cool. Get a chance. So.
Cool.
All right. With that, we'll go ahead and sign off and say see you later.
Later.
If you want to get a hold of us, send an email to info@idahistory.com. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Ida History. You can visit us on the web at idahistory.com. Ida History would like to thank our listeners, sponsors, and contributors. If you want to know how you can become a contributor, go to idahistory.com/podcast. Please consider giving us a rating and review on your podcast app. I'm Tom Hart, and this is Devil's Counting.